only white people are capable of democracy.
Wow.
So if you're not white, you're ruining America's Republican experiment. And if Latter-day Saints are facilitating race mixing, and most states in the nation have laws against race mixing, then, you know, you are a problem in the 19th century. It was called the Mormon problem. You know, claims a revelation in which Jesus is speaking in first person voice in 1831, all flesh is mine and I am no respecter of persons.
Mm. Wow.
What color of flesh does Jesus not claim as his own?
Yeah.
The first documented Black Latter-day Saint is 1830 in Kirtland, Ohio, and there have been Black Latter-day Saints ever since. Five revelations that say the gospel is to be preached unto every creature. We love to say every nation, kindred, tongue, and people. Every creature leaves no room, no wiggle room, right?
Yeah.
Who does that leave out? No one.
Never.
The intent is for every creature to be introduced to the gospel message. And early Latter-day Saint missionaries took that seriously. I mean, that's what the evidence demonstrates, right? They're baptizing free Black people, enslaved Black people, and white enslavers. Like, every creature includes all of those people who are a part of this civil period in the United States. And then Joseph Smith, you know, claims a revelation in which Jesus is speaking in first-person voice in 1831, all flesh is mine, and I am no respecter of persons.
Mm.
Wow.
What color of flesh does Jesus not claim as his own? Like, this inclusive language is just embedded in the scriptures of the Restoration. The revelations of the Restoration are inclusive.
Really everyone who would hear to come. So there's a gratefulness about that, and that its foundation, we were all included.
Yes.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to this episode of Brothers in the Foyer. My name is Crispin. We got a few of the brothers in with us right now. We got Will to my right. We've got Andrew right next to him, Isaiah, and as you can see, we have a special guest who is not one of the brothers in the foyer. Our special guest today is here because this is episode 2 of our series on Blacks in the Priesthood and how we're going to dive into its history, what that was, and our perspectives on it as we learn more.
Yeah.
So we have invited this special guest. His name is Paul Reeves, and he is a Simmons Chair of Mormon Studies at the University of Utah. So we have Paul here today. He's a historian, author as well. He's got different books that we're going to get into a little bit today as well. But that's why he's here. And we're really excited to not only have him, but to get into the more factual-based situations about Blacks in the Priesthood. And not only are we going to learn more about that from Paul, but we're going to give you our perspectives as we learn together with Paul. But first, Paul, I would like to just kind of have you take some time right now and just kind of let us know how you became the Simmons Chair of Mormon Studies at University of Utah and how you decided to kind of publish written work about race in the priesthood.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with everyone. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely.
So I was doing research at the University of Utah and reading whiteness studies. So this is these are histories of, for example, Irish immigrants who come to the United States. They're not necessarily accepted as white on arrival. There's this racialization that takes place, not necessarily white enough. Historians have written about it in terms of an immigrant and labor history. And I noticed similar things when I was reading 19th century Latter-day Saint history. Mm. So Latter-day Saints were being denigrated as not white enough. And it felt like something was there. And I also was never satisfied with the existing explanations for the racial priesthood and temple restrictions. So I thought if I can combine my own personal curiosity with, you know, an academic study, all the better. And I spent a summer at the Huntington Library in California that has a large collection of anti-Mormon tracts from the 19th century, Protestants writing about who they thought Mormons were. And I thought if this is a thing, it will emerge from this. And so I spent a summer there, and sort of the chapter categories emerged from that summer. And Religion of a Different Color, Race and the Mormon Struggle for Whiteness was the book that Oxford University Press published as a result.
Mm-hmm.
And it lays out the racial priesthood and temple restrictions in a broader context, but also the way that Latter-day Saints in the 19th century were denigrated as not white enough. They were conflated with Native Americans, with African Americans, with people of Asian descent, and people imagined that Latter-day Saint polygamy was facilitating race mixing, denigrating the white race, deteriorating the white race, making it unfit for democracy. Senator Calhoun says on the floor of the United States Senate, democracy is the government of a white race. His belief was that only white people are capable of democracy.
Wow.
So if you're not white, you're ruining America's Republican experiment. And if Latter-day Saints are facilitating race mixing, and most states in the nation have laws against race mixing, then, you know, you are a problem in the 19th century. It was called the Mormon problem. Some even medical doctors suggested that Latter-day Saint polygamy was giving rise to a new race. So polygamy in the minds of outsiders is not just destroying the traditional family, it's destroying the white race. And how do you claim whiteness for yourself in the 19th century? It's in distance from blackness. And you see Latter-day Saints then moving away from their own black converts, implementing segregated priesthood and temple restrictions. And I think firmly in place by the beginning of the 20th century at the height of American segregation.
Wow.
So that's sort of the basics of that story. I trace the trajectory from not white enough in the 19th century to too white by Mitt Romney's run for the presidency in the 21st century. And Latter-day Saints respond by trying to claim whiteness for themselves in the 19th century, and by the 21st century, trying to claim a more racially and internationally diverse identity for itself. So that's sort of religion of a different color in a nutshell. And then Deseret Book, when it was conceiving of its Let's Talk About series, which is designed to address sometimes controversial topics, came to me and said, hey, can you kind of boil that down for a general Latter-day Saint audience and basically tell the racial priesthood and temple restriction story for a Latter-day Saint audience. I expressed skepticism.
That's about it.
Yeah.
Because I didn't think Deseret Book would be willing to publish, what I wanted to write. I didn't think that they would be willing to go where I thought this topic deserved to go. I didn't think they'd be willing to be as open and honest as I felt like this topic deserved. And they said, that's what we want to do. Give us a shot, trust us with this. And the book is the result.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Wow. So
it's going to be crazy because I got a quick question. It's going to be hard. I do have a question. So most of the people that came over to America were immigrants. So my question is, who was the spectrum that was considered white, and whereas if other immigrants were considered not white enough? The core group, I guess.
Yeah.
That was kind of said in that mode.
Yeah. So as they imagine it in the 19th century, so race is illogical. It's fluid. Nationality and religion get mixed in with race in the 19th century. The most direct answer to your question is that Anglo-Saxons.
Okay.
They believe Anglo-Saxons are at the top of this racial hierarchy. And then even Irish, Italians, right? So people from Southern and Eastern Europe, don't fit, right? So the imagination is, so Anglo-Saxons, move across Europe, inhabit Britain, and then jump the pond and establish democracy, right? And therefore, whiteness and freedom are combined in their minds. Mm-hmm. And Anglo-Saxons are at the top of the racial ladder. And so other groups, even if we might today see them as whites, right, they are denigrated as not white enough.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates this very fluid racial context in which even an insider religion like Mormonism can be also denigrated as not white enough.
Or even not Christian enough.
Not Christian enough. Yeah.
That flipped over to now modern times, so we're not Christian enough.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Huh. And they get mixed together in the 19th century, right? So, you could be white until you convert to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, even though the vast majority of those who are converting are from Northern and Western Europe, the same locations that you know, are seen as the source of Anglo-Saxon identity. But I have a chapter in Religion of a Different Color that is, you know, talks about the new race, right? And so you have the New York Times going to a Mormon immigrant ship, and they're saying, like, you know, Welch immigrants are fine, but Mormon Welch immigrants are dirty. And from the dregs of European society, right? So they are racializing even those immigrants who are coming over from Northern and Western Europe.
Wow. I have no clue.
Gosh. Okay. So it's really funny, or funny isn't the right word, but it's really eye-opening to kind of put the dots together. Because growing up, what I did hear in... whether it's from like parents and grandparents, things like that, was, or even in some movies or TV shows, was little hints at things like that about how like Irish was different than white and things like that. Like that you kind of saw in like old movies and things like that, but it didn't really stick out being a black boy watching this, because it definitely wasn't at the spectrum that it was for me, as far as like what we weren't allowed to do and how we were treated. Right. So it kind of just goes over your head a little bit. And then now, to be talking about this and have all the, you know, the, we'll say, contention around this topic, even now, you know, how it happened, why it happened, this, that, and the other, to find out that there might be a little bit more behind it than just plain old racism, I'll call it, is really eye-opening to see, especially when you look at it on the spectrum like that and see it from that perspective. So it's really interesting that you said that. But my question comes to this early on in the church, and you mentioned it yourself, because somewhere along the line there were limitations placed on, you know, church participation and temple ordinances and things like that. So before all that happened, what was the experience of the black members who were baptized, who did hold the priesthood and were participating in those ordinances? What was that experience like before things started to change?
Yeah, so great question. And it sort of brings up the structure of the book. So I see the racial history playing out in three phases. Mm-hmm. So the first couple of decades, open priesthood and temples.
Right.
And then it transitioned to segregated priesthood and temples. And, you know, that is not firmly in place at Brigham Young's first utterance, right?
Right.
That takes on a life of its own across the course of the 19th century and develops and fits and starts. And I think firmly solidified in place under Joseph F. Smith in 1908. And then 1978, the third phase with President Kimball's revelation restores the church to its universal roots and actually reconciles it to the founding scriptures of the Restoration. So, you know, that first phase, there was just no evidence that there was a racial priesthood or temple restriction in place under Joseph Smith. In fact, the opposite is true. We have Joseph Smith sanctioning the ordination of black men to the priesthood. We also have, in 1840, the first presidency writes an article in the Nauvoo newspaper, where they are really exuberant about the nature of the gathering that has taken place up to that point. And they're really excited, you know, if the gathering continues to take place the way that it has to this point, they say, we can imagine the shivering Laplander, the degraded Hottentot. Uh-huh. Hottentot is a 19th century term used to describe tribal South Africans specifically, or tribal Africans generally, right? Mm-hmm. So they're imagining Hottentots immigrating to Nauvoo, mm-hmm. all of these people gathering in response to the gospel message that they're sharing. And then they say, and they will worship with us, people of every color, they're explicit words, people of every color will worship in the temple, which they will start to build the following spring. So, you know, they published that in the Times and Seasons newspaper in 1840, but it's, you know, on record from the first presidency, simply their vision for he will be welcomed to the temple. Mm-hmm. We have Elijah Abel, who is the most well-documented black priesthood holder, ordained to the priesthood in 1836 as an elder. Joseph Smith sanctions that with his signature on his ministerial certificate a couple of months later. He's ordained a member of the Third Quorum of the 70 by the end of 1836, but he also receives his washing and anointing rituals in the Kirtland Temple mm-hmm. in 1836. So Kirtland, right? There's evidence that Elijah Abel is not barred from the temple rituals that are developed to that point.
Right.
That's as far as this temple ceremony and rituals have been introduced to that point. And then, you know, we have Kiwaka Lewis in the Little Massachusetts branch, who's functioning as an ordained elder, ordained by William Smith, Joseph Smith's younger brother, who was an apostle at the time. We have, in the Century of Black Mormons database that I oversee at the University of Utah, Sarah Ann Mode Hoffhines, whose mother is white and father is black, and in early census records is black. She receives full temple rituals in the Nauvoo Temple, and then is sealed to her husband after they migrate to Utah. Anyway, so those are just examples of open priesthood in temples. Not that things were racially all hunky-dory during that period, right? But nonetheless, there is no evidence that there's a racial priesthood or temple restriction that is traceable to Joseph Smith.
Okay. That's, first off, thank you for that, because it's really refreshing to hear that. On a lot of different levels. And I'll just speak for myself and just other people who have just kind of chimed in through our Instagram channel and other places on just saying how the way it started is the way it is now when it comes to who's allowed to do what and who's allowed to participate, and how there's a thankfulness or a gratefulness at the fact that Joseph Smith, whom we recognize as the prophet of what we call the restoration of the gospel in 1830, did that under the direction of God, having seen him and spoke with him, and then turned about to then invite any and literally everyone who would hear to come. So there's a gratefulness about that, in that its foundation, we were all included.
Yes.
So there's, thank you so much for that confirmation and clarity, because knowing that, I think, really helps a lot of members around the world to just know that at its roots, we were not only meant to be here, we were here.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah.
The first documented Black Latter-day Saint is 1830 in Kirtland, Ohio, and there have been Black Latter-day Saints ever since, right? But just to emphasize your point, right, so before I started writing this, I read the Doctrine and Covenants with a racial lens, right? And I would challenge your listeners to do this, because it emphasized to me so the openness of those revelations, right? So I hadn't recognized this before, and I've been reading the Doctrine and Covenants my whole life, right? But five revelations that say the gospel is to be preached unto every creature. Mm-hmm. We love to say every nation, kindred, tongue, and people. Every creature leaves no room, no wiggle room, right? Who does that leave out? No one. The intent is for every creature to be introduced to the gospel message. And early Latter-day Saint missionaries took that seriously. I mean, that's what the evidence demonstrates, right? They're baptizing free Black people, enslaved Black people, and white enslavers. Mm-hmm. Like, every creature includes all of those people who are a part of this, you know, mix in the antebellum period in the United States. And then Joseph Smith, you know, claims a revelation in which Jesus is speaking in first-person voice in 1831, all flesh is mine, and I am no respecter of persons. Mm. Wow. What color of flesh does Jesus not claim as his own, right? Mm. But I've read those scriptures before until you sort of recognize and read them racially, right? Like, this inclusive language is just embedded in the scriptures of the Restoration.
Yes.
And I'm not denying, you know, the challenges of the racial passages in the Book of Mormon. I'm not suggesting those don't exist. And obviously the Book of Abraham, you know, I address that here, but nonetheless, the revelations of the Restoration are inclusive.
I love that.
Yeah.
Is it safe to say that some of the persecutions that the church had at that time was because of the inclusion of, you know, Black people and how they integrated and just accepted them? Is it safe to say that some of that persecution arose because of that?
100%. Yeah. So, 1833, Missouri, right? So Joseph Smith has defined Jackson County, Missouri, as Zion, as the gathering place. And W.W. Phelps is the editor of the Evening and Morning Star newspaper, Latter-day Saint newspaper in Jackson County. And he writes an article called Free People of Color. in the Evening and Morning Star. And he says, okay, you know, to my fellow Black Latter-day Saints, Zion has now been defined as is located in a slave state. We have no special rule in this church as to people of color, he says. Okay, so once again, if you want to suggest that the racial restrictions are in place from the beginning, you have to argue against the evidence. Mm-hmm. We have no special rule in the church as to people of color, but the state of Missouri does. Mm-hmm. To my fellow Black Latter-day Saints, if you're going to gather to Zion, you need to be aware of Missouri state code that prohibits your ability to move freely in this state. Mm-hmm. If you come to Jackson County, he quotes two sections of the Missouri state code right there in his article. If you come to Jackson County, you have to have papers that substantiate your status as a free Black person, or you are subject to being whipped and expelled from the state. And I don't want that to happen to my fellow Latter-day Saints. So he says, let prudence guide. That's enough for outsiders in Missouri to form a vigilance committee. And they say, Mormons are inviting free Blacks to the state of Missouri to incite a slave rebellion. So some slave states basically say you can't free, you can't, if you are a white enslaver, you can't individually manumit your slaves without permission from even the legislature in some states, right? Yeah. And if you're a free Black, some states write laws that say you have to leave the state within a certain amount of time, right? And for Missouri, you have to have papers that substantiate your status as a free Black. But remember, Nat Turner's rebellion has just happened.
Yeah.
There's fear around the slaveholding states that Black enslaved people are going to rebel, right? And so Missouri outsiders, when they read Phelps's article, they say, okay, Mormons are inviting free Black people. They're going to incite a slave rebellion, and they're going to steal our white wives and daughters. Mm-hmm. Projecting fear of race mixing onto the Latter-day Saints almost from the beginning.
Wow. That gives so much more context.
It does.
Yeah.
Whoa. I think I know about 50% of that. But like the rebellion that happened, that gives a lot of context to why people were so much on edge. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they were already they were worked for the abolition or anything, the movement. But that shows why their mindset was there anyway, and it just progressed further.
Yeah.
Right.
Wow.
I mean, so newspaper articles is what I looked at, right? How are Latter-day Saints sort of being described by outsiders? So they have created an asylum for rogues and vagabonds and free Blacks. Mm-hmm. They're promoting Black ascendancy over the whites. So these are accusations that are being leveled against Latter-day Saints in Missouri. And by the time this all plays out in 1833, right, they attack Phelps's printing office. He writes an extra. He tries to calm people down. He says, oh, I didn't really mean that. And in fact, Black people aren't, you know, accepted. So when pressure comes, right, white Latter-day Saints are going to once again fold. Yeah. He writes an extra, tries to calm people down. They storm his printing office, destroy the extra, destroy the original article that he wrote, scatter his type into the street, and haul two Latter-day Saints into the town square and tar and feather them, which is a 19th century ritual of violence that basically marks you as outsiders, and this is a warning, you need to leave. And that's the beginning of the Latter-day Saint expulsion from Jackson County. So 1,200 Latter-day Saints are expelled from Jackson County, Missouri by the time this all plays out, and it's over the accusation that Latter-day Saints are too inclusive. Yeah.
Oh my God.
And we feel like when you read it and we see portrayals of it, we feel like, or we get the, I personally, I'll speak for myself, get that it was just all because they wanted to practice their faith. Like, we don't get to see and understand, like, the actual background of these things that's actually happened. So this is definitely eye-opening.
Yeah, I think adding the racial lens to that, right? It's not that they're not being denigrated as racially different, but how do you justify an extermination order against people who look like you?
Yeah.
You suggest that they're not, in fact, like you.